This session is entitled, Shall the Youth of Zion Falter? And we will hear from Steve Bickmore, who was the 1992-93 Sterling Scholar Teacher of the Year for the state of Utah. He teaches English at West Jordan High School. He graduated with a BA in English in 1978 from BYU, and then got his MA in English from the University of Utah a few years after that. He taught at Bingham High School for a year before going to West Jordan High School, where he has been for the entire 12 years of its existence, I believe. And he proudly reports that he teaches beginning Latin as well, and they actually have 55 incoming students who are signed up to take Latin at West Jordan High School. So that is good news. He served a mission to Buenos Aires, Argentina, from 1974 to 76. He is married and has 5 children, and he occasionally sells shoes. His wife just completed, well, she's working on her dissertation right now and just became a professor at Community College Salt Lake campus, also in English, so he doesn't need to sell shoes quite as much. He has participated in 2 NEH-sponsored seminars and in 1 NEH institute. And he was the first recipient of the NEH sabbatical that was sponsored jointly by NEH and Reader's Digest. Is that correct? He has vested much of his career to improving the lot of education, particularly in the state of Utah. And I look forward to hearing his remarks about what the status of the Youth of Zion is today. And we will move the mic over here. Yes. National Endowment for the Humanities. Excuse me.
Yeah, NEH is an evil organization, not quite as evil as NEA, of course, you know. Much more evil organization, National Endowment for the Arts, for the Humanities. They are one of my favorite organizations. Now, I guess if they can't pick up my voice, they'll come in here and say, we can't pick up your voice? Okay, so I need to kind of be close. Oh, yeah, you had to show up. I don't know how long I'll sit down. I don't know how long I'll stand up. And I'm not real sure if I care if I'm interrupted either, if you have questions or comments. Because Cindy couldn't find anybody in the world that would respond to anything I would say. Because I feel free at any time to change my stance. You know, if anybody opposes me, then I would say, pfft. Okay. I also just want to make a couple of disclaimers. I should have this in a more complete finished form. I have about 2 rough drafts, and I spent last weekend in Las Vegas. I graduated from high school in Las Vegas, so I was at my 20th anniversary. Now, and that was an interesting thing and relates to what I want to talk about later. And also, then I spent this week, I came home Sunday afternoon, and I spent this week at Bear Lake with scouts. So, in case there was any question in anybody's mind about the Youth of Zion faltering, the answer is clearly yes. You know, now the question is to what extent, and do they bother to get up, and some of those things is a question. But I heard and used language that surprises me, and I had to have a direct. You know, I hate being like the authority figure, but the main scoutmaster left Wednesday, and so I was in charge for a day and a half. You know, and that means you have to have direct talks with youth, which is, you know, when you say, you're going home with me, because I already am going home on Friday if you don't shape up. And I've had a, since I talked to Sydney, this has been a topic that has concerned me for quite some time. And my wife has participated regularly, I think, with Sunstone for probably 6 or 7 years in a variety of feminist issues and scriptural interpretation issues, all of which mean little or nothing to me, really. Okay, in the abstract running of my life, they mean quite a bit. But as a career school teacher and as a father of 5 children, it seems to me that Sunstone and other organizations as an intellectual focus pay very little attention to the training of the Youth of Zion. But at the same time, those same organizations will complain about the state of youth and say, oh, the decay of young people, oh, what little of their accomplishments compared to what we accomplished, any number of things. Oh, they're influenced by this and that and television and movies and music. And I'm sure if any of you have anything to do with education, you are well aware that those complaints can be found in almost any era of history. We have writings from the Greeks where they complain the same way about their generation that's following them. It's not unique. So, however, I would like to talk about things that I think, trends that to me seem disturbing when I have to watch my children participate as members of the church, of the Mormon church, as members of this community as a whole, and as participants in a school system that, even as a professional, when I even know what's going on, scares me. In lots of ways and for lots of reasons. One of the questions, if I were a bishop, or I were a young women's president, or a young men's president, one of the questions that that has to run through their mind is, are our youth prepared? Well, that's a pretty abstract question. Prepared for what? Prepared to be married? Prepared to serve missions? Prepared to not only be married, but have children? Hold down jobs? Function decently in our society? What is it that we, as members of the church, if we talk about the youth in Zion, want them to be prepared to do? I think it's a very essential question. And I think it's one that we do not hear talked about by very many groups. You will occasionally hear one or two talks addressed directly to youth at general priesthood meeting, at conference, perhaps. And I would venture to guess that if we did a study of how many talks were directed specifically to youth, 18 and under at conference, that it would not be every 6 months. At the general women's sessions now, I would venture to say, having never attended one, you know, which I should start doing, I suppose, are there very many talks addressed to specifically to young women? Okay, usually one or two. That's kind of like the general priesthood meeting. Yeah, and that's pretty much the pattern at general priesthood meeting, the same kind of thing.
A lot.
Yeah, well, there's lots of things that are changing. Yeah. Oh, really? Interesting. Divide and conquer? Or divide and support? I mean, there's lots of questions you could ask about things like that, but it seems to me that we have an overwhelming population of the church that is young, and we are constantly distressed at how well they do. Constantly. Now, one of my contentions is, I can remember back up. It's not, in some ways, from lack of general response to preparing the youth. From general leadership of the church. I do not lay much bulk of the blame about the position of our youth on general leadership of the church. I don't think that's the case. I think there are plenty of manuals. I think there's plenty of instruction. I think there's attempts at multitudes of in-service that goes unused and unheeded by the adults in the church that are theoretically teaching the youth. Now, who are they? First of all, the frontline educator of the youth, in my mind, are parents, varieties of teachers, presidencies, both from women and men, young women's, advisors at every level from 12 up, and then bishoprics. In my mind, one of the things that could be increased is a more active role of the Relief Society presidency in ushering and nurturing in as well. The same way that the bishopric tries to do, on the other hand. There are very few people that take the time to train themselves to teach the youth of Zion, in my mind. Yeah, and I... Well, for years, the theory has been, we have children, you can teach. You can go to primary and you can... We're in a class. I had taught 10 years, and I was assigned to teach the Blazer Bees. Few things have rocked my testimony as hard as 3 years of the Blazer Bees. I mean, it sounds funny, but I say that with all sincerity. The third year of that, it was just almost beyond my ability to get up on Sunday morning and go to church, because I knew I was going to have to sit there and sing, you know, any of those primary songs that they didn't want to sing, and I would try and be enthusiastic singing Give Said the Little Stream and Nephi Share of Old Time and the Golden Plates, and I thought, please, some old ones that I know, and I said old ones that I know, because I can't even remember the ones I learned. But it was also the same year that I was on sabbatical, and so I spent that year knowing that I was going back in the classroom, wondering that if my whole ability to teach had just gone somewhere. And then I started evaluating the 8 boys that I had in this group. I only had 2 that were from what you would classify as active families. The rest were from part member families, completely inactive families, and they were totally unprepared to enter the world, let alone be 11. It was a scary thing. When I realized about 3 of the 8 could not read, well, then telling them to get a testimony of the gospel, when you can't read Moroni 10, 4, and 5, becomes a little bit difficult. Well, now, is that youth going to falter? He's not going to falter. He's going to stumble. He's going to fall. He's going to feel like weights are laid upon him. He doesn't want to come to Sunday school because Brother Bickmore is going to ask him to read a scripture. What do you do? Do you talk to the parents? Well, how many of us really are concerned about the youth enough that it becomes the same kind of time that a Relief Society puts in, or a primary president puts in, or that the bishopric puts in many, many instances? As much as I don't like to call upon one, some of the general authorities you like better than others, you know, you have favorites, you know. Okay, I guess we can talk about all this kind of stuff at Sunstone. I told Cindy I'd talk about whatever I wanted at Sunstone. But often, I would say that President Packard, who I wouldn't necessarily always pick as my favorite as a humanities major, talks often about that the strength of the church only lies in the strength of the generation, of this current generation's testimony, and its ability to usher in the next generation's testimony. And he has done several talks about that issue. That's, in my mind, the biggest question about the youth, is are we ushering them into a spiritual life that will nurture them and sustain them through the trials and tribulation of the liberal and conservative argument that we insist on maintaining throughout the church? Is the core foundation of spiritual strength given the youth? And how do we do that? So my question, like I said, if you read any of the brief before, and I tried to scan through when I first got the program, I don't think that there are more than 2 or 3 Sunstone sessions that deal at all with youth. Okay? I mean, 3 would be about right. Maybe if some of you surveyed it and counted it better than I did. 2? Mm-hmm. So 3. And I don't think there's more than 3. I think 3 was my count. Well, we've spent a lot of time realizing that the needs of women in the church are underestimated and under addressed, and I think that's true. But a large bulk of our population, as I mentioned before, is very young. And we are sometimes more concerned about ourselves as adults than we are about the generation that we're ushering in. And many of us are responsible for bringing them here. Now, I don't think that we're consciously neglecting them. Because I think on the surface, we can point to lots of things that we show that we think we are doing. Now let me pause again. I grew up, I never lived in Utah. And this is one of the things that probably has irritated me over the last 13 years as a school teacher. I grew up, I was born in Las Vegas, Nevada. I moved to El Paso, Texas. Went to school there for a while. Went to school in Tucson, Arizona. Both in El Paso, Texas, and Tucson, Arizona, I was often the only LDS kid. And I say often because I can remember one other time in junior high when I had another Mormon kid in my class in Tucson. Then to high school, to finish junior high and high school, I spent time in Las Vegas, Nevada. And I assumed when I went to Las Vegas that we would be the only Mormon family. You know, I knew that we'd lived there before and there was a few. And I was absolutely startled to move to Las Vegas, Nevada in 1968. Summer 1968. And find out that there were 28 wards and 5 stakes. I mean, I came from Tucson. I thought, you know, there was a stake. And I, 5 stakes in Las Vegas, Nevada. There were Mormon kids around. Well, I grew up in that environment, and I must tell you that in the 5 years I lived there, before I went to college at BYU, Las Vegas grew from a Mormon community of 28 wards to 60 wards in 5 years. So Mormons are in Las Vegas. You know, lots of them. And all of a sudden, I went to school where I was not the only Mormon in my class, where I went to school and the kids I went to church with were almost 100% in the same school. And for most Mormon kids, that was the case, except when I went to high school, we had one of those wards where half went to one and half went to the other. And so we didn't talk for a couple of weeks during football season and a couple of weeks in basketball season. That was when I look back on that, I thought that having that many Mormon colleagues as a student and as a youth was a remarkably sustaining thing in a city that is often very difficult to live in. I mean, if there's a vice, you can find it in Las Vegas. Okay, and I'm not peer pressure, elements of the world. It's there and fairly readily available in Las Vegas, and they really don't much care what age you are. I mean, I never had any trouble wandering a casino if I wanted to. And the point is that it seems to me that I grew up in an extremely nurturing LDS environment where there were lots of things for me. Now, I haven't talked to my sister as much about this as I probably should because she was a year younger than I was, and maybe as a female, she didn't feel the same kind of nurturing, because certainly the sports program was not as good for her. But most of the social activities I was required to take my sister to, so I know she went to as many of it. As I was thinking about this, one of the things I felt was most nurturing is that a large percentage of us graduated from seminary 4 years, a large percentage of the Mormon kids. And there is something extremely nurturing. Turn the page to make Cindy feel comfortable. There's something extremely nurturing in my mind, I think, about meeting in the morning with an attitude of prayer and study, where all of a sudden, with or without makeup for the girls and the boys, half awake, all of a sudden, however far they got in the lesson, sometimes we didn't get very far, I must tell you, but we started the day as a group with prayer, and often with testimony from our leaders, from the teacher who was teaching that class, who was usually someone either in our ward or in our stake, someone who was not abstract, who was not someone sent from on high, as it were, to teach gospel principles. These were adults that we knew and saw. And I think I had 3 teachers. One I had 2 years. You know, I had like when I was a sophomore and then again, or when I was a senior. I often have thought over the last 2 months, I guess now, that really that was one of the strengths of my adolescence. Is there was an expectation by every other kid that we went to school with that we were the Mormon kids. Now, I don't want anybody to be misunderstood that there weren't Mormon kids and Mormon kids. But it was extremely clear in my high school which kids were the kids who were active Mormon kids. There was no hiding that we were Mormon kids. And the kids who were inactive and already drinking or doing whatever they were, they were also known. I never experienced pressure, and I don't know of a personal friend who ever experienced the pressure to drink or smoke or take marijuana in a high school where they say, my high school, the average was 90% of the kids a year took marijuana in the early 70s. I never once was pressured by a non-member. Any pressure that I ever received was inside church activity. non-members respected my position, and most of them understood exactly what it was. Okay? Now, given that experience, this is a town that's maybe 15% Mormon, maybe 10, okay, given all the range of Mormon. When I was a senior, there were 7 high schools in Las Vegas. 5 of them had Mormon student body presidents. 5 of 7. And 1 of the 7 was a Catholic high school. So let's throw out the Catholic high school. 5 of 6. Naive fool that I am, I went to school at Brigham Young University, went on all these experiences, you know, went on a mission, came back, graduated with a bachelor's in English, and then decided to teach. Crammed all my teaching classes in the short period of time, which I recommend intensely. The shorter the better. And I thought that I was going to get a job in Utah. And that's where my wife was. She was finishing a degree, and we didn't see any plans of leaving in, you know, the next 2 or 3 years at least. And my, if you've read the blurb, my expectation of what I might find in a Utah, Salt Lake City high school, given the population, at the time I started teaching, I think the Mormon population of this valley was 65%, 12, 13 years ago. I think it's decreased significantly from that, about 45 or 50, I think. I don't think we're a majority, although people may think that. I don't think that's the case anymore. Maybe right around 50, it hovers there. Yeah, Sunstone would know those statistics, wouldn't they? I mean, we could probably find one that has it exact. But, you know, we are having births here. You know, we could keep track of that. I expected that the Mormon kids would, first of all, and see, when I say, shall the youth of Zion falter, I don't necessarily want you to think that I think they should falter in any major ways or that they do falter in major ways. Kids falter. Adolescents falter. Those sixth graders and seventh graders that I had at scout camp. Lots of faltering. But at the same time, lots of support, lots of peacemakers, lots of people stepping between people who want to stone each other, to use a biblical term. Lots of good things to counteract the faltering. You know, I don't think, and if there's any of you that have made it through life without faltering, just please talk to me after. I want the secret remedy or whatever, because I think that seems to me that one of the 4 basic principles of the gospel is repentance. And the reason we have it so close is because we need it so constantly. I thought, however, that Mormon kids would not be ashamed to be Mormon kids. And I don't think that I've found that true all the time. In fact, I think I can give you many, many instances where that's not the case. I also thought that that a sense that they were a unit, that they had common goals and common expectations, would be more clearly established in a high school. And my bulk of my experience is in a high school. I mean, I spent 3 days in a junior high, so you know, I can't talk there. But in a high school, that there would be an attitude and a flavor that would permeate and lift those kids. Because in my experience, I remember that being the case. That the Mormon kids were often class officers, student body officers, valedictorians. The percentage of valedictorians in Las Vegas at my high school that were LDS is far and away higher than any other. To use other statistics, Eagle Scouts. I mean, if you were going to take a boys' organization that in Vegas, there were lots of scout troops that were not LDS. You know, because the PTA sponsor, here PTAs don't sponsor them because they say, well, the Mormons, you know, have it. But PTA sponsors more scout troops than the Mormons do. Did you guys know that? They're the number one, not us. So in Las Vegas, almost every PTA had a scout troop. We chose not to be part of that scout troop and were part of another one. There were, you know, I know 4 or 5 really good Catholic, long-term scout troops in Las Vegas. Big traditions, really great. You know, not 20 kids, 50 kids, 60 kids in scout troops occasionally. But still, Eagle Scouts, the people who stuck it through and finished and achieved were LDS. I thought that there would be a more lifting attitude. I thought, as I read my contract in Jordan School District, I'm required to teach moral values. It's in our contract. They don't give it to us anymore. You know, because when you give teachers contracts, we read them and then we fight about them. But if you were to go if you were to go get a contract for Jordan School District, one of the requirements is that you teach moral values that are defined as Judeo-Christian values. At the same time, you better not mix church and state, but you're required to teach ethical values. Now, as an English teacher, anything that's written is literature. Foolish me, I assume that it's written, you can use it as an illusion. I can't tell you the number of times that I have asked somebody to talk about the parable of the 10 virgins and gotten no response whatsoever. Now, two things are happening. Either no one in that classroom knows the story, which is a serious faltering on the part of the people who are teaching these people, or they know it and are afraid to admit that they know it, or three, which I think is a false, they are not leaders, they are not letting their light so shine, they're finding as big a bushel as they can to hide it under, okay? Or four, they know it, they don't understand it. They don't get it. They don't know what it means. That's a serious, those are the kinds of falterings that disturb me the most, is that we have no understanding of our religious tradition. Now, that's a biblical tradition. I often have Christian Protestant kids who know the answer and volunteer it. I rarely have had Mormon kids who will volunteer the answer. Now, if we've created a culture in this valley that makes Mormon kids who know these answers afraid to say the answers, then something is seriously wrong with the Youth of Zion, in my opinion. I think that that is a serious flaw. If I ask somebody to tell me the story of we get all kinds of literature where there's symbols of three and they go into darkness and no one sees them for a while. And I say, well, what kind of symbol is that? Well, I don't know. You know, and I say, well, remember that Joan in the well story? Who? Is that the white one? You know, they don't know. You know, some of them have read more comic books than that. But I ask, Cindy asked me the wrong year, because if I were to pick out of the 13 years, you know, my most successful in the classroom, last year wouldn't be it. The irony of that is last year was the year I was awarded KSL, Deseret News, Sterling Scholar, Most Inspirational Teacher of the Year, stood on the stage, couldn't hear any instructions, you know, leave or go, stood on the stage and got this award for Most Inspirational Teacher. I tell you that I felt anything but inspirational during the last 9 months. It was very frustrating year for me, very frustrating. Not so much that I changed my curriculum. I was teaching exactly the same preparation that I've taught for 3 years running with regular and increased success, and this group of kids scared me. The other thing is, the other answer, remember that question? They don't know it, they're afraid to know it, they don't want to lead. Well, the other one is, the other thing that seems to me is absolute indifference, that they don't know it and that they don't care that they don't know it. And this is the story. Two girls come to my class late. I'm giving a quiz at the near the end of the year, preparation for taking the advanced placement English exam, which is a hard test, very hard test. And two girls want to walk in 15 minutes late, 10 minutes late, still take the 45-minute quiz, you know, 45-minute objective quiz that is a practice exam for this test they have to take in 2 weeks, 10 days. And they want to take it. And so I say, we can't take it. This is one of those deals where your lamp isn't quite full. Which lamp is that? And I said, now, where are you late from? And I knew darn well where they were late from. They were late because they were at seminary. Oh, heavy irony. They're over there being taught all the responsibilities of the world and can't get their little butts across the parking lot responsibly into my class to take an exam they know that's going to happen over and over again. And I say, I told them, why don't you go back and get a note and get some oil for your lamp while you're over there, specifically that one that's called responsible behavior. And they didn't think it was very funny. You know, one of them didn't get it, and I think the other one had to, you know, quickly explain to her. We're being slammed again about that parable of the virgin. And it's one that I use all the time. the first time I used it last year, I used it, the terrible of being prepared, on the seminary president. Regularly came to my class unread, unprepared, and unwilling to discuss if called upon. Now, I know I like the seminary teachers at my school quite a bit, and I know that they don't think that they choose these presidents and leaders lightly. Well, my response last year was, if this is the best of the crop, burn it, let it lie fallow, and let's plant again. I mean, you know, maybe some years we just need to let the ground rest. Because it's a very difficult thing when the kids who are elected to lead and serve as examples for this, you really, at the end of the year, don't develop much respect for. Now, I don't expect that, and by that I don't expect for these kids to be necessarily A students in my class. I've respected a lot of students over the years that really, in an advanced placement class, were good C+, B- students. And some of them, although they may never know this, and that's probably one of the problems with education, have developed and earned more of my respect than A students. I had a kid last year, in one of my most horrible years, I must, you know, who I respect greatly. He took no honors classes till his senior year, woke up, you know, he was an athlete, woke up at the beginning of his senior year and says, maybe I want to go to college. Maybe I want to do well. You know, I gave my lecture at the beginning of the school, this is a hard class, got to read all these books, I show them to him, you know, how fat they are, and I say, you don't want to be here, you should probably go somewhere else. Kid stayed after the first day, says, I haven't been in any honors classes, I don't know if I can do this, but I want to do this. I want to try. Right up front, I said, fine, I'll look at your first writing, I'll see how you do. I've learned a long time that I can is a lot better than any of the test scores, you know, and any of the placements. Sometimes if a kid says, I can do this, he can. And he passed the advanced placement test. And frankly, his writing at the beginning of the year was very bad. You know, it was horrible. He had not been practiced. He took English classes where writing one essay a semester or a quarter was all he had to do. The fact that I was making him do one every 2 weeks or every 2.5 weeks was a shock to his football system. But in the midst of football season, he made more progress in the first 10 weeks of school than most of my students make in a year. Because he knew, he believed me when I said it was hard, and he believed me when I said he had to read. And then I did something that I shouldn't tell teachers I do because they think I'm insane. I let any student rewrite any essay they want. And I will automatically improve their grade if they rewrite it. He rewrote every essay for the first half of the year. You know how many essay rewrites I averaged out of 50 students every essay? About 3. And I wasn't getting all A's. A's, B's, C's. 3 kids on the average would rewrite an essay for a better score. And I wasn't really concerned necessarily if it were a much better essay, as long as things improved, as long as the kid was learning something. And this student did a tremendous job of feeling depressed, you know, walking in saying, what's really the bad parts? I said, well, everything in red, or, you know, my little note. And I'm not a big red person, you know, in the pen, but I do little notes. I like the introduction. I didn't like any of the support. The end was spelled correctly. But sometimes that's what I felt about this kid's papers, is they were just, you know, but he worked very hard. Now, it's not necessarily significant that he passed until I tell you something else. Last year's average, my pass rate was 80%. Very good. National average, 67%. 80% is very good. Not as good as Alta or Brighton, you know, or some of the illustrious places where I think they're afraid to go home if they don't pass. But my pass rate this year was 60. 60. I had a 20% drop. I'm afraid I don't have a job. I haven't gone to the high school much this summer for fear that, you know, you can teach remedial. See if you can. And so when I tell you that a kid really worked in my class to pass, who I thought didn't have a prayer, and made it, that was significant in a year that I thought was disastrous. Now, you know, why was it disastrous and all those kinds of things? That is another argument altogether. But the seminary president didn't pass. because he never did get that idea that he was supposed to come prepared. Those girls whose lamps weren't quite full, one passed one test. She took two, because this year they had language on one day and lit on the other, so they could take two. Fortunately for her, she took both, because she passed one. And the other one didn't pass either. I had very many diligent students pass who worked hard, and I had bright students who did not. And you know what most of them are? If it's interesting to divide by a religious grouping, and we're talking about the youth in Zion, my biggest disappointments are the active, outgoing, good-looking, Wonder Bread fed, Word of Wisdom keeping Mormon kids. Now, did somebody go and visit every mutual in West Jordan and tell them that if they looked good and they wore Dockers, that they would be successful in life? I mean, I don't know what that happened. They didn't come to visit my class. And my conclusion, now that I've spent, half 40 minutes is hammering the youth of Zion and telling you these horror stories, is that I don't think it's their fault. I don't think it's their fault. I think that the fault rests squarely on the shoulders of some of the people we talked about before. And that's what I don't think that they have a clear enough vision of what they are from their parents and from their leaders and from adults in general. I think students, adolescents, children are the best mimics in the world. They are imitating so accurately the behavior of their parents, their leaders, occasionally their peers. But I don't know if anymore I buy that. I think they imitate the behavior of the strongest peer, but the strongest peer is imitating the behavior of adults in society as he or she perceives them. And I think that's what's wrong. I think that... I used to think, I will solve this problem with parent-teacher conference. Second, third week in October. I'm going to solve this problem. Well, the parents either did not show. You can't solve a problem if you don't see the parents. Second of all, you talk to the parents about 2 minutes and you want to find the kid, hug him, and apologize for the fact that he has the parents that he has. And the last thing you want to do is say anything negative about that kid, because you realize that his day-to-day existence has got to be more horrible than anything you ever imagined. Now, I know you shouldn't judge people in 5 minutes, but it was startling to me as a new teacher, and that has continued on for 13 years. I hold now a back-to-school night. One of the only teachers in my building holds a back-to-school night. I tell my kids, I threaten them, I say there's extra credit points, which means they'll do it. Heaven forbid you do regular work, but extra credit work you will do. So I tell them extra credit if their parents come to back to school night. And my attendance is about 75 to 80% of parents. And I tell them I hold this because they don't come to parent-teacher conference. I don't tell them that I hold it because it's good for them, although it is. I tell them, we used to hold back to school nights all the time, constantly. I said, we didn't stop holding back to school nights because the teachers quit coming. Universally, schools quit holding back to school nights because parents quit coming. What kind of message does that send a kid in an honors class whose parents won't take the hour to go find out what the class is involved? How seriously is that student going to take the class? The behavior of the parents is practiced by the children. It's remarkable to me when they come and some of the parents want to argue about what I'm teaching. Not because it has moral objections. Not because it has a questionable word or two. It's so long. It's so old. Wake up. Seems to me my job is to train them with the most rigorous task that I can, to challenge them daily, to make every assignment worth their doing at a difficult, manageable level, and their parents are making excuses for them. They should read all 12 of these books this year. 12 books? When I was in high school, I didn't read 12 books. When I was in high school, I was assigned that, I didn't read it. And their kids are sitting here. okay. Then the next week, or, you know, the next 3 or 4 days, I have to spend time saying, your parents, tactfully, I'll tell you this directly, your parents are idiots. You know, your parents are lazy, they're unmotivated, the world is more difficult. What the average, and I don't, this has changed, 10 years ago, last time I heard the statistics, people are re-educating their fields every 7 years. Their knowledge has absolutely changed in most fields in the United States. Every 7 years, an engineer relearns that much more information. Okay, in almost any field. Could you imagine being a doctor? I mean, I would never be a doctor because it's constant school. You know. And do you guys want a heart surgeon who's still operating like in MASH? You know. No, you want a heart surgeon who's done the... I do. I don't want a C student. I don't want just the medical diploma. I really want to see the grades, or I want the doctor to convince me that he was top of his class or her class. You know, I don't know if they are, but I've convinced myself that my doctors are really good. 10 months ago, we had a son diagnosed as a diabetic. No, we just found any doctor to take him to after that. No, we did our very best to find out who are the best pediatric diabetic doctors in this valley. Not just anybody who will take diabetics. And I applauded my family practitioner doctor when she said, no, we're really too busy to continue to be his pediatric doctor. You should go to this doctor or this doctor. And, you know, that doctor just, my family practice doctor just elevated my opinion because she had enough courage to say, or reason or rational thing to say, you need to go where the best is. Well, I don't know if they go their best. True to the faith. That's what did you guys know that was the title now of Shall the Youth of Zion Falter? I mean, that's such a negative title, so true to the faith. Yes, question or comment or complaint? You must be one of my students. Did I have you last year and you just didn't come or no? Scary, isn't it? Yeah, my theory about education is this. First of all, it's not going to get better generally. It will get better specifically with specific teachers. I take a lot of flack in my high school for having a back-to-school night because other teachers feel like they ought to but don't want to. And so they do that. I had a student teacher, and last year she was not a student teacher. She was an intern, so she had her own classes. And I said, guess what you get to do, Sarah? You get to have a back-to-school night. And I did it. This last year was my third year in a row that I did it. It's one of the decisions I decided when I came back from sabbatical is I was going to make every effort I could to contact parents more often. And a back-to-school night was the best way. Last year I had two other teachers besides my intern come and say, what night are you doing it? I'd like to just do it on the same night so that we have that wing open and people can come in. And I think lots of problems are pre-solved that way. One of the things you can do as a parent is complain to say, you know, if you feel like your student's going to have a... We have two AP teachers at our school, and as much as originally neither one of us probably wanted it, if we were both honest and open, we both recognize that having two of us teach two classes is much better than having one of us teach four. It's better for the students, and it also gives them an option. I know I've had kids that have dropped my class because they do not want to hear me pontificate or moralize or make them read 12 books when they can go to the other class and read 8 or 9. And I know that I've had students leave her class and come to mine. Same thing. The extension of that is I also think if you get it back to a religious context, we don't choose our primary teachers. And sometimes they don't choose themselves. We don't choose our scout leaders and they don't choose themselves. It's like we had the big lecture the first day I was at scout camp. They were all the scout masters and said, you may not be alone with a scout. You may not go in a scout's tent. You are too deep all the time. Two adults, one kid. If there's a circumstance where it's gone, it is at least one adult and two kids in the open if you have to do that way. They don't want to be sued and they don't want to. And they say, if you violate that, you will be dismissed as a volunteer permanently from Boy Scouts of America. And we nodded. Well, yeah, that'd be tough, wouldn't it? Bishop, I can't be in the scout. You know, but at the same time, you know, we laughed about that. But this year at the camp that I was at, they have dismissed two scoutmasters. Both for physically hitting scouts, just hitting them. One scouts had tied up another scout and were going to shoot him. BB guns, I have 22, throw rocks at him. And he came in storming emotionally and hit the kid with the gun. Or what BB, I assume it was a BB. I hope they weren't going to shoot him with 22. But they say that it was really very seriously that there was criminal. The police came also. But he was dismissed from scouting, justifiably stopping something. But nevertheless, he can no longer be a volunteer. And they had another incident that was similar to that, where maybe you could justify, you know, I told my kid I could still hit him a little, you know, within the realms of the law, which, you know, but my kid was good, though. Of course, his dad was there. What's he going to do? You know, but that's a problem. Now, and I think that this, it extends into the church, that we can't choose these things, and it's a community. We are supposed to be a community of saints. Now I'm going to get religious for just a few minutes. When we moved last summer, I deliberately chose a house in West Jordan. I'd lived on the outskirts of West Jordan. I'm attracted to the idea of living where I teach. Some people hate that. I like knowing my community. I like knowing that there are places in my community that I would not live, or try very hard not to live. And there are places in my community that I would struggle so that I can live there. That was important to me. And I want my kids to go to school where I can watch and help choose. You know, teachers have a very unique thing that if you are teaching in school, you can choose your students, your kids' teachers. And if you are, they may say you can't, but you can. And the more you are active in your school and PTA, you can choose. The more you are active in your ward, you can begin to choose. You can begin to influence that. But one of the first things I did is, as an active member of the church, it's important to me that other people in my congregation know that I have testimony. And I try and take, if I move, the opportunity to bear that testimony early on. But one of the things I also said is that I would be in this ward to help their children as well as I expected the people in my community of saints to help my children. Because I know that I can't teach them everything. But some of the other people that they can teach them. I cannot be every example for my children, but other people can. And one of the things that I requested is that as I tried my best to help them and their children, that they also tried their best to help my children. And vice versa. You build a community of saints. Now, in the chorus to this fabulous song, which we used to sing tons. I mean, when I was a kid, we sang this song a lot. I don't know if we sing it as much anymore. And maybe it scares us as adults. Because maybe the preceding generation, no offense, people who may feel their preceding generation to me, maybe as a group, I don't know if we do this as actively. But the chorus is this. True to the faith that our parents have cherished. True to the truth for which martyrs have perished. To God's command, soul, heart, and hand, faithful and true, we will ever stand. How can the youth of Zion not help but falter if they have absolutely no idea, as LDS youth, what the truth or what the faith that their parents cherished is? Have you been to wards where the youth bears more testimony than the adults, and when the adults bear testimony, you keep wondering whose testimony it is? You know, is it of AAA? Is it a travelogue? Is it of kindness? But it seems to me that the only rock of foundation that exists for a Mormon youth, that the faith that I think my parents cherished and that my ancestral parents cherished, the ones who left Switzerland, the one who left Wells, was that they believed that Joseph Smith was a prophet who received revelation and reorganized the Church of Jesus Christ on the earth. And with it, the understanding of the atonement and the priesthood that works the ordinances of those things. That's the faith that I try and teach my children. Now, do I do it perfectly? Am I a perfect example? Not by any means. But in my mind, that's the focus. When it's my third week in Deacon's Quorum, I try not to let a lesson, I don't care what the lesson is about, it ends up being about Jesus Christ and Him crucified. And the fact that we know that in the way that we know that through modern revelation. If the youth of Zion don't have that, then we are no longer the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. We are the Church of Jesus Christ of lapsed Mormon community. We are the Church of Jesus Christ of Mormons who like quilts. We are the Church of Jesus Christ who get to argue not only the Bible, but the Book of Mormon. We are the people who get to argue over hieroglyphics in the Pearl of Great Price. But if we, as a community of Zion, worried about our youth, do not teach them about the faith, then we will lose them. They will falter and they will not come back. They will not come back. If they do not have a spiritual anchored, they will falter. They will be afraid to say, I know what that parable means. I know what that reference is. I know how the scriptures read. For which martyrs have perished? Do we understand that term? What is a martyr? Is it only Joseph Smith? I think when this song was written, it isn't only Joseph Smith. It's your ancestors who died in the Donner Party. It's polygamous women who were left years and months without a man and raised children. It's the people that Brigham Young sent on missions because he didn't like arguing with them anymore. Maybe that's what in the church they ought to do now. Every time they get mad at somebody in Sunstone, they ought to send them to Palestine for 3 years. You know, and say, here, you think it's hard to be a leader in Zion? You go run a mission of 200 youth and then come back. Because I guarantee you'll either have a testimony or you won't, and then it'll be pretty easy. Okay? Then you either decide to do or not. To God's command. And frankly, in the world that I see it, there are less and less adults. I would just be terrified to ever have to be a bishop in this anywhere. The number of people that, in my mind, obviously want to redefine what God's commands are when all of us really know that they're pretty simple. You can read the Ten Commandments. If we only practiced on the Ten Commandments, then it's pretty simple. But the number of people who want to don't you just hate the debate about, do you pay tithing on gross or net? Pay it on whatever you want and you feel good about. But not paying it till you figure it out, they just can't decide. Is it net or gross? And until I feel good about it and have a personal revelation, I'm not paying it. You get the feeling that sometimes we want to rationalize it. Well, let me tell you, if you rationalize everything that hits you, now, do our children have to learn to rationalize? Well, I think they do because they have to survive in this world. There's constant rationalization. Do you say this to your boss or this not your boss or, all those kinds of things. But if they do not know by their family and by their adult leaders what God's commandments are, and that their parents are faithful to them, they won't be faithful. In my mind, as a teacher, one of the things that we're told to do, and maybe one of the most important, is that we magnify and understand our talents. Boy, that's just... And that relates to education in my mind, because we're told through the scriptures that not only do we have certain talents, but we can gain any talent that we want. We can search that. We can develop that. Well, that's a scary notion. Soul, heart, and hand, faithful and true we will ever stand. Soul, heart, and hand, faithful and true we will ever stand. From a silent, halfway interested, somewhat liberal, perhaps doctrinally more conservative, it seems to me that there is a lot of wavering in Zion. Youth are not good with wavering. It confuses them. And when they waver and they're indifferent, and let's take something as simple as, which for me is not simple, R-rated movies. I can't tell my kids not to go see R-rated movies, so I've seen my share. Until I become more firm, probably we'll see some others. Now, I always rationalize, I don't see anything that has ski in it, on the title, or hot tub, or, Halloween. I have theoretic qualifications, and I've rationalized in my mind that there's a difference between that R-rated movie and others. But nevertheless, I've rationalized. Now, do I have a clear enough thing, conversation level with my children? I don't know that. It just seems to me, as I mentioned what I perceive the problems, that the key is, much with our generation, it is with the generation that follows us. And I've taken a lot more of my time than I probably should have, and probably haven't left you any time for questions. But it's a fascinating thing working with the youth, and it's a more frustrating thing when you realize how few adults are willing to do it. The question is, what do you do to help youth or kids, students? Well, I must tell you that the only reason I'm still teaching is 5 years into teaching, and I shouldn't get emotional about these things, but this is pretty emotional for me. I wouldn't stay teaching. I can sell a lot of shoes. I mean, I really could. I mean, I think if you can sell shoes, you can sell about anything, so I could make money somewhere else. But I've been teaching about 5 years, so it was probably 82 or 3, and I went. I listened to conference, and one of the talks was how Jesus taught his disciples to see the people they were teaching as he commissioned them to go out at the end of his life as individuals. Oh, it scared me to death. Because, first of all, I realized that's how I really saw them, was as individuals. And if I felt that I was good at what I did, and I felt that I was pretty good at it from the beginning, I felt I could handle it, but it was frustrating. And I decided right then and there that I would try every day to see them as individuals. When you see them as individuals, it's scary. You also realize more of their problems and more of their successes. But I came back the very next day, this is the middle of October, and I stood at the front of the door and I shook hands with every kid. You know, I think some of them started to look for the, you know, the funny farm jacket. You know, they're going to haul me off. But do something that would remind me why I was dealing with kids. And in some ways for me, it was as much a mission as a job, something that I felt I should do, because there's other things I could do better, but I was good at this, and I was tolerant enough to maybe stay the long haul, because some teachers aren't. And for the first 5 years, really never considered another profession, you know, seriously. Some Fridays, you know, you consider another profession, namely axe murderer, you know, some of those things you consider, but really not. And the key for me was to, for about 2 weeks, I shook every kid's hand, you know, 180 hands a day. But I wanted to re-anchor. I wanted to give them that moment of my eye contact, because I felt that maybe then, during the course of the day, they would listen, or they would volunteer a problem, or they would see me as someone that they could come to or turn to. And it happens more often than you want it to. You know, sometimes you're just... And I try to be loud and cantankerous to scare some of them away, because I figure then the ones that will still come, I really should give more of my time to, if I haven't scared them away with belligerence and whatnot. Yeah. The question is, do I have anything specific in mind where people should take time to train the youth? The ironic... Train themselves as adults. Right. The church, for example, has Teaching No Greater Call, as hokey as the manual is. About every third article in there is really pretty good, and no one reads it. I took teacher development as a student at BYU, and then I taught teacher development about 5 years ago, and I went, this course is pretty dang good. You know, from an educator's point of view, there's a lot in here. How to arrange a room, how to do everything, how to deal with problem children. So Teacher No Greater Call is a really good resource. The other one is the video system in the church is absolutely outstanding. I was working in the young men's stake young men's presidency in a previous stake just before I moved a year ago. And our stake president said, every youth leader is going to see this video. And, you know, he was right. It was an absolutely tremendous video, the one about training the Aaronic priesthood. And I said, foolish me, shouldn't we also train the women leaders? He says, that's a great idea. Train all the women leaders. Show it to all the, every presidency. And so each one of us over ward showed it not only to the young men's presidencies, but the young women's presidencies and the bishopric. We all had to report back. They've seen it. There were 6 parts. He said, I'm not going to make it hard. Each part's about 15 minutes. One every other month. And in a year, they'll all have it. And it's very good. It teaches you how to teach kids to have spiritual stewardship. Because you know what? That's the key. If they can have spiritual experiences as youth, if they can have that anchor, they'll survive if they have a strong enough spiritual anchor. But we have adults teaching them who don't have those spiritual anchors, who are just trying to be the best they can sometimes. And so there are lots of things. My contention is that many of the answers are there. First of all, they're here. Most of all. If you can get yourself to read this, you know, I want to axe murder kids, and then I'll read in here about patience or, you know, tolerance and turning the other cheek, and I say, okay, you know. But, you know, I did a 50-mile bike hike on Wednesday because it was about time for me to ride my bike 50 miles so that I would get through the rest of the 2 days, you know. And I went around Bear Lake, and I was much better when I came back, you know. You know, my 3.5 hours alone was gave me another room of patience. So learning your own, like one of the scout leaders, and I hate to use the Boy Scout so much because it sounds like I'm a professional Boy Scouter, not necessarily the case, but they said, one of them said, he said, I play rugby for BYU. I'm up here working this summer. He said, I would take it as a privilege if you feel the need to beat up. Last thing I'm going to do is beat up you because you're big and you play rugby. But the point was taken. If you've reached your level where you just can't deal with youth, then maybe you need to back out. You know, maybe you need to go. More kids, more teachers. This should be added to all the videos. If you can't take it, you should get up, leave the class, and say, I'm sorry. I'm not coming back until one of your parents is here or your parent. We should remove ourselves from situations where we don't do well. And I think that's in public school as well as in a church setting. But a church setting for me is more important right now. Most of you are going to have to deal with youth. And your number one call to them is to make them, in my opinion, feel the Spirit and to teach them that they can feel it on their own. I asked my 12-year-old on the way down the mountain from Bear Lake, what's the most important thing for the youth? He said, to learn to pray for yourself. I thought, okay, that's good. We're winning that war. I said, anything else? He said, he says they have to read the scriptures for their own answers. But I didn't have enough courage to ask him what that meant, you know, really, you know, because that's kind of a scary thing. But it's difficult to do, you know. And, you know, another one is follow the counsel of the brethren if you want to be a great teacher of youth. One in particular for parents, read the scriptures daily with your family, even if it's one page. I think it's remarkable how we've tried to do that. I don't mean to hold myself of any model, but through good and bad over the last 2 years, we've tried very hard. And it is a marked difference, not in my own life as I go off to school, but in the lives of my children. I know that my children have read Moroni 10, 4, and 5 because I was there when it happened. And I know that if one of the scriptures is that I can talk about it. Now, do my wife and I see every scripture the same way? No. You know, do we see the church exactly the same way? No. But do our children together, are we giving them the habit of reading the scriptures and turning to them? Yes. And otherwise, it's just a club. You know, this is just a big club of people with same heritage, same tradition, same whatever. And I don't need any more clubs. Do I need a community of saints that will constantly reinforce my own spiritual experiences so that my own personal spiritual experiences, those of my children, will be magnified? And that in difficult, troubled times, I can have enough humility to turn to my knees, and so can my children. Now, I don't know.
Thanks so much. It's the plenary session next in the Three Seasons Ballroom.